everybody. You know, I'm not going to be here next week. I have to eat a lot of the week after. I have to go to Chutz Laretz. So since we're not going to have any shiur until Purim, basically, so I wanted to discuss an aspect of Megillah that sometimes people do not discuss at all, and that is the historical background of Megillah Esther. You know, books of Tanakh begin in the middle, so people don't always have a sense of like what happened before and what is the background of the particular story of Purim. So here we have to go back and kind of do a very, very quick survey of the historical events. And that is, we know that from the time of Yehoshua ben Nun until the Churban Beis HaMikdash was a total of 850 years. We can prove this because the Pasuk in Malachim tells us that Shlomo HaMelech built the Beis HaMikdash, completed the Beis HaMikdash, 480 years after we left Mitzrayim. That's kind of the foundation of a lot of biblical dating. Now, if it was 480 years from the time we left Mitzrayim, and we wandered in the desert for 40 years, then the Beis HaMikdash was built after we were in Eretz Yisrael 440 years. The other date we know was that the Beis HaMikdash stood 410 years. Therefore, the 440 plus the 410 gives you a figure of 850 years. Now, Rashi brings in Chumash from a Medrash that this was actually 2 years earlier than it should have been. The Beis HaMikdash should have been destroyed after 852 years because the Pasuk says, Hashem will destroy us and destroy the land when we are v'nayshantem b'yaretz, when we're in the land a long time. And Rashi says the gematria of v'nayshantem is 852. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu was makdim the Churban two years earlier, so that he wouldn't have to fulfill the pasuk that says, I would utterly destroy you. The Golus was brought earlier, so our Averas should not have reached the critical mass of 852 years of Averas, which would have been Mechayev HaKadosh Baruch Hu to destroy us.
Where is this pasuk?
This is in V'yeschanan. We read it on Tisha B'Av. Ki solid banim v'nei banim, when you have children, v'nei shantem v'yaretz, and you're there a long time, and you will do Avodah Zarah. Ha'idaisi b'chem hayayim, ayameyet ki avo toveden maher. So Chazal say he was makdim 2 years to v'nayshantem in order that he wouldn't have to fulfill I will destroy you. Okay? Now, the thing is that this period of 850 years has many sub-periods. For the first over 300 years was the period of the Shoftim. There was no king. Rather, Ish kala yasha b'ein av yasa. There was no central government, but whenever there was a need for a military leader, you know, we appointed a shofet, and then we went back to Hefkeris. Eventually, in the time of Shmuel, there was a king. But if you remember, Shmuel Hanavi actually said HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not happy with people choosing a king because they should accept HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They shouldn't need a Basar V'dam. The first king was Shaul HaMelech. Was essentially deposed because he failed to carry out the one mitzvah that he was given, and that was to totally eradicate Amalek. Shaul HaMelech spared Agag, the king of Amalek, and although indeed Shmuel killed Agag, but according to Chazal's Mesira, in the interim Agag managed to impregnate somebody, and that woman gave birth to a child who became the ancestor of Haman, who is called Ha-Agagi. But it's interesting, you know, all of us know Haman is from Amalek, but you know, it does not say explicitly, the reason why we say Haman is from Amalek is only because he's called Haman Ha-Agagi. Now that could mean anything. But Chazal say that Agag is none other than the king of Amalek that Shaul spared, and Haman is descended from that king of Amalek, therefore he is called Ha-Agagi, descended from Agag. That is why it was so important that Mordechai and Esther, who are the descendants of Shaul, rectify the pagam of Shaul. Shaul's chait was in not destroying Amalek. Mordechai and Esther are given the kayach to be mesakein that which Shaul was not able to do properly. Okay, so we have Shaul, and because of Shaul's chait, the malchus was taken away from Shaul, and it was given to Shevet Yehuda, and in particular David HaMelech, and David HaMelech was followed by Shlomo. So there are only three kings of the Jewish people who ruled over the whole nation: Shaul, David, Shlomo. After Shlomo's Malchus, the kingdom was split. 10 tribes rebelled against Rechavam, who was Shlomo's son, and they established their own kingdom, which became known as the Northern Kingdom, or Malchus Yisrael. And the Southern Kingdom comprised only two tribes, Yehuda and Binyamin. Actually, the truth is, they comprised three tribes: Yehuda, Binyamin, and most of Shevet Levi, because obviously the Kohanim would hang around the Beis HaMikdash more. So you might be asking, well, so how do you get 10 tribes, in other words? Well, the short answer is, technically there are 13 tribes, because there are 12 tribes that got portions of Eretz Yisrael, and you're counting Ephraim and Manasseh as two. So essentially, you have 13 tribes, because, you know, Yosef, but Ephraim and Manasseh are counted as two. So therefore, Yehuda, Binyamin, and Levi were the kingdoms of the south, Malchus Yehuda. The other 10 tribes were the kingdoms of the north. And Malchus Beis David only ruled over the southern kingdom, and Malchus Yisrael was in Shomron. They ruled over the northern kingdom. Now, if you look at the book of Malachim, you see an important chiluk between Malchus Yehuda and Malchus Yisrael. Malchus Yehuda is essentially an unbroken dynasty of son after son after son, going from Rechavam all the way to Tzidkiyahu, is a succession of sons, once in a while a brother. In other words, a king dies and his brother becomes king. In Malchus Yisrael, there is virtually no dynastic succession. By that I mean, there were so many coups and revolutions and assassinations that you never have any family keeping Malchus for more than three generations. After three generations, somebody moves in and kills and takes over. Occasionally, there was even civil war between the northern kingdom and the south. Okay, and most of the northern kings were not good. They were Rishon. And the southern kings, you have mixtures. Some were tzaddikim and some were not. Chizkiyo was a great tzaddik. Chizkiyo's son Menashe was a Russian. Now, you have these two kingdoms, and then eventually Sancheriv, the king of Assyria, became a world empire. Sancheriv destroys the northern kingdom around 120 years before the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. So the last 120 years of this 850-year period, all you have is Malchus Yehuda. Malchus Yisrael was destroyed by Sancheriv. Now here, though, I just want to correct a misperception. That is the origin of the idea of the lost 10 tribes, because Sancheriv exiled... First of all, he killed many of them, but he exiled the 10 tribes to different countries, and therefore their whereabouts became lost, and they became assimilated, and the like. Now, because of that, a lot of people think, oh, well, if I'm a Jewish person, I could only be from one of three tribes. I'm either a Yehuda, a Binyamin, or a Kohen or Levi. I can't be from Reuven or Shimon, because they were lost. See, that's not true, because even though Sancheriv destroyed the kingdom and exiled a lot of the population, there were always individuals from any of the tribes who lived in Malchus Yehuda. They immigrated for Parnassa or whatever it is. So consequently, any Jew alive today could theoretically be from any tribe. You could be a Reuven, you could be a Shimon, you could be a Yisachar. Your kingdom got destroyed, but you know your ancestors could have been living in Malchus Yehuda anyway, right? So it's not true what people often say, that every Jew identifies as a Jew must be from those three tribes or from Gerim. You can be from any tribe. However, it is very true that much of the 10 tribes became lost and assimilated, and for really thousands of years, people have tried to identify different groupings as being connected to the lost 10 tribes. The Ethiopian Jews, or at least the ones that might be Jewish, claim that they are descended from the tribe of Dan that somehow got to Africa. In the 19th century, there was a popular theory that the American Indians were from the lost 10 tribes. There are those who believe that the Pashtuns is are the largest tribe in Afghanistan. Even Pashtun sounds a little bit like a Jewish word. Pashtun, right? They're the ones who don't like pilpul. They go for pshat, right? The Pashtuns. But, yeah. So the Pashtuns are 30 million people. And some have posited a Jewish origin, that they got somehow lost. And they're practicing Muslims, but they have some Jewish customs. They fast on Yom Kippur, which is actually unknown to Islam, but somehow they got some Jewish custom in there. They circumcise their children at 8 days. Now, Islam does practice circumcision, but they don't believe in 8-day circumcision. Now, Yishmael circumcised at 13, but most Muslims don't wait till 13. They do it earlier, but they don't insist on the 8th day. They'll do it at 3 years old or whatever it is. But the Pashtuns do Bris Mila, and practice of Islam, their Islamic circumcision, they do at 8 days old. So it's interesting that you have some evidence that there's some Jewish lineage. Now, that doesn't have to mean the 10 tribes, but someone are connected to the 10 tribes. Okay, yeah.
Is there a Gemara somewhere that says that Yirmiyahu brought back the 10 tribes?
Yeah, there is a Gemara that says that, but there are opinions that say it didn't happen. I mean, probably what's going on is that some were brought back and some weren't. That's all you could say. In other words, it's not really a machlokas, but one is emphasizing, as I said, that there were those who remained. After the destruction of the northern kingdom, they migrated to the south, and they became part of Malchus Yehuda. Now, obviously, once Sancheiriv successfully vanquished the northern kingdom. Now remember, I want to point out, this was the last stop. He had already conquered Egypt, right? And then he conquered the northern kingdom. So he figured he might as well clean up and get Malchus Yehuda as well. And indeed, he did vanquish much of Malchus Yehuda. He destroyed many, many cities and took prisoners and enslaved many of the populations. But his last stop was Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash. And the king of Yehuda at the time was a great, very great tzaddik. This is Chizkiyahu HaMelech. And Chizkiyahu HaMelech prayed to Hashem, and there was a great, great miracle that 180,000 soldiers of Sancheiriv, a huge, huge army, they miraculously died through a plague in one night, wiping out virtually the whole army and sparing Yerushalayim. This is recorded in Sefer Melachim, but according to Chazal, this occurred on the first night of Pesach. One of the miracles that occurred on the first night of Pesach was Yerushalayim was spared. Now, Sancheiriv himself survived, and he hobbled back to Assyria, where he was killed by his own children. And Chazal also say that one of the foot soldiers in Sancheiriv's army was a young man called Nebuchadnezzar, who later became the king of Babylonia, who destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. But he was himself a witness to this great miracle as a young man. Now, this miracle was an amazing miracle at the time. This miracle was considered, many people thought Mashiach was here, this is the final Geula, there'll never be a Chorban, who knows, Chizkiyahu would have been the Mashiach. And in fact, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin that had the Jewish people been worthy at that time, that would have been the final redemption. And there would never be another Chorban or Golos again. That was
before
how.
The first Chorban.
This is before there wouldn't have been a Chorban. There wouldn't have been any Chorban at all. That just would have been the Geula. And yet we were not Zeicha. And in fact, the Malchus Yehuda hobbled on for a while, much for over 100 years, till the eventual Chorban Beis HaMikdash. Chizkiyahu was a righteous king, but virtually all of the kings that followed him were not righteous, except for one, except for his grandson Yoshiyahu, that had a brief reign. But other than Chizkiyahu and Yoshiyahu, virtually all of the Malachim afterwards were not tzaddikim, and even when they were tzaddikim, the people were doing Averos, Beseser, and the like. Yes, he's the very last one. I'll get to him. He's the very last one. So, now, yeah.
Was there like a certain merit of the plague coming through and wiping out this?
Well, the merit was Chizkiyahu's tefilas. Yeah, Chizkiyahu was a great tzaddik, although the Gemara in Bracha says he didn't want to get married because he knew with Ruach HaKodesh he would have an evil son, which he did. And Yeshayahu said he was going to die because he had no right to second-guess Hashem's mitzvahs. And according to Chazal, he married Yeshayahu's daughter, thinking maybe that's the best insurance policy. But Lamaisa, he had Menashe. Menashe became a king at 12 And Menashe ruled for 55 years. It's the longest reign of any melech. And it was a total Russia. And it is said that although the Churban didn't happen in Menashe's reign, but the final gezerah that there would be a Churban was made in Menashe's reign. Now, as an aside, this is way before Purim, way before the Churban, as an aside, let me mention, you know, we have Sefer Melachim, we have the Book of Kings, and then we have another book that overlaps a lot with the Book of Kings, and that's Sefer Divrei Hayamim, which is called Chronicles. And it's hard to understand, it's hard to understand the Book of Chronicles, because when it's the same as Kings, you wonder, why do I need the same thing in two books? When it contradicts, you have a kash, it's a contradiction. So either way, Divrei Hayamim is going to be a shver sefer, because it's either redundant or it's contradictory. I mean, you kind of have a tzarechian no matter what you do. But one of the most interesting stiris between Divrei Hayamim and Melachim is how to view Menashe. Right? Menashe had this long reign from age 12 to age, for another 55 years, till 77. I'm sorry, till 67. So he didn't die particularly old, but he ruled for a very long time. When you read the Book of Melachim, he is a Rasha mitchilaso v'ad sofo. There's nothing good about him. Totally evil, despicable, murderer, oved avodah zarah. But when you look at Divrei Hayamim, you read an amazing statement. You actually read that in the last decades of his reign, like the last 20 years, Menashe became a Baal Tshuva, because apparently he was taken prisoner, he was kidnapped by Babylonians and then released, etc. And through that experience, he turned to Hashem with all of his heart and all of his soul, and he became a righteous king. That's a pretty big stira. According to the Book of Melachim, Menashe was a Rasha Gamor. According to the Book of Divrei Hayamim, Menashe is a Baal Tshuva. How do we reconcile it? So one of the Bali Musar says a very, very interesting pshat. He says the following. He says that one of the ways you can understand the differences between Divrei Hayamim and Melachim is Melachim is focusing on the role of the person as king, and Divrei Hayamim is focusing on the person as an individual. So here's the problem with Menashe. Menashe's Averos, on one level, are his personal averus. He did many, many bad things. But Menashe also created an atmosphere in Eretz Yisrael that was mashpia on others. You know, if the king on top is doing averus, that creates a chilul Hashem, right? In other words, everything is created by the person on top. So Menashe is not just a chayte. Menashe is machti es harabim. Now, here is the issue. If I'm chayte, and because of my chatoyim, I am mashpia on many, many people to do evil, even if I do tshuva on the bad things that I did, how do I undo all the spiritual damage I did for others? So this is the nafkamina. From the perspective of Menashe as an individual who did bad things, Menashe was a Baal Tshuva, and the Eibishter forgave him, and all of his averus are nimcha. But the Book of Malachim are saying his legacy as king was one of complete evil, because his personal tshuva could not erase the pigamim that he caused in everybody else's ruchnias. That's a very, very important idea. If I'm machti as a rabbin, in a way, there's no real way I can be a complete Baal Tshuva, because even if I can rectify the evil that I did, unless they do tshuva, I cannot rectify the evil that I made them do. Right? And therefore, that's the nafkamina. Malachim is evaluating Menashe as a melech. As a melech, his rishus remains. Divrei Hayamim is evaluating Menashe as an individual. As an individual, he taka was zeicha to be a Baal Tshuva. It's a very, very interesting machshava. It's similar to what the Chafetz Chaim said, just in a different context. Somebody asked the Chafetz Chaim, how do you do tshuva and lashon hara? It's a famous, famous story. So the Chafetz Chaim says, I'll tell you exactly how you do it. Get yourself those feather pillows that are stuffed with feathers. Stand up on the roof and flap the pillow till the feathers fly out. And that's how you do tshuva. So the person said, I don't understand. He said, oh, I forgot to tell you, there's another step. And then put the feathers back into the pillow. Now, that's pretty impossible. The Chafetz Chaim says, that's how you do tshuva for Lashon Hara. When you can put the feathers back into the pillow. Right? In other words, you say Lashon Hara, you hurt a person's reputation. How do you change that? Right? In a way, true Lashon Hara is even worse than Motzi Shemra, because here's the thing. If I lied about you, so the Chalapach, as I can tell people, oh, I lied. Maybe they'll believe me. But what if I said something true about you that's derogatory? What do I do true? I says, well, I'm sorry I said this. It is true, but, you know, I shouldn't have said it. What do you do? Are you allowed to lie? That's interesting, Shaila. Are you allowed? If you said true Lashon Hara about somebody, are you allowed to tell people that you lied in order that he should be less harmed by your Lashon Hara? Is that called lying for Darche Shalom? Right, you are allowed to lie to make Shalom. Is this Nichlal in lying for Shalom? That's an interesting question. But basically, the Chafetz Chaim is saying, you really can't. It's very, very hard to undo the negativities of Lashon Hara. That's why, you know, when newspapers have a front page story about somebody doing something wrong and it turns out to be false, so they always say, the story of the wrongdoing is on page one, and the retraction and the apology is buried on page 52, you know, the bottom of the second row. Oh, we're sorry, we. Although it's interesting, just to tell you how the people make these mistakes. And the Panovich Rav, it's just a story that just occurs to me. The Panovich Rav was in Panovich before he came, you know, before World War II. It was after the Bolshevik Revolution. He was the Rav of Panovich. And the Bolsheviks were just, you know, they were shooting different people who were considered collaborators with the Tsar. So one night they just burst into his house. He's learning. They put a gun to his head. They're about to shoot. And then one soldier says to the other, you know, maybe we have the wrong address. And they check, and it's the house next door. They go to the house next door. The Panovich Rav hears two shots. And like, that's the end. The soldiers don't come back. Yeah, I mean, basically, there was such a callous rush in killing people, you know, that, you know, they were about to shoot him because they didn't check the address exactly. The last minute, they said, oh, let's check the address. So it was somebody next door who unfortunately got killed. But okay. And in any event, yeah, that's Menashe. Okay. But after Menashe, things were really falling down very drastically, except for Yoshio, who was a very righteous king. Now, eventually what happened was Babylonia became a world empire. Babylonia is modern-day Iraq. Right? Babel. Babel became a great empire under this king Nebuchadnezzar. And Babel attained its eminence in stages. It first conquered Assyria. It then conquered Mitzrayim, and then it turned its face towards Eretz Yisrael, which is Malchus Yehuda. And the conquest, the Babylonian conquest of Eretz Yisrael, took place in three stages. So it's important that you know these three stages. If you know these three stages, you'll appreciate Megillas Esther much more. Stage number one was Kibush. They conquered Malchus Yehuda, and they made it a vassal state. There still is a Jewish king, but the Jewish king has to pay tribute and taxes. This is called Kibush Yehoyakim, because the Jewish king at the time was a man called Yehoyakim, who was a great, great Russia, an awful, awful Russia. But he reigned for 11 years, and it was during his reign that Nebuchadnezzar conquered Eretz Yisrael. There was no Chorban Beis HaMikdash, and there was not even a gullus. Nobody was exiled. But Eretz Yisrael became subservient to Babylonian rule. That's called Kibush Yehoyakim. The one person who was killed in that conquest was Yehoyakim himself. Yehoyakim was killed by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, 7 years later, because of a certain amount of revolutionary activity on the part of the Jews, Nebuchadnezzar exiled a certain segment of the population. And this is during the reign of Yehoyakim's son, Yehoyachin or Yechaniah. That's the same name, Yehoyachin or Yechaniah. And this is 7 years later. and that is called Galus Yehoyachin. And the segment that was exiled are given the designation Charash Umazker. The Charash and the Masker were exiled. Now, what is the translation of Charash and Masker? So literally, Charash are carpenters and Masker are locksmiths. So why did Nebuchadnezzar exile carpenters and locksmiths? So some Mefarshim say very pashut, Nebuchadnezzar wanted to exile skilled craftsmen who would be capable of making weapons. Carpenters and locksmiths, they can make weapons, bows, arrows, swords, spears. He wanted to remove people who could make weapons so there wouldn't be a military threat. However, Chazal have a different interpretation of Charash and Masker, and they say Charash and Masker refer to Talmidei Chachamim, and Charash comes from deaf, or mute rather in this case, and that is people who were so great in their Torah learning that whenever they spoke, everyone else was mute, they had nothing to say. Masker is, they closed up all discussions, meaning once they said something, there was nothing to argue with. Now, Mordechai, the Megillah makes reference to this first galus, because it mentions that Mordechai, Asher Hegla Mirushalayim, right? He was exiled from Yerushalayim. Im ha-gola asher ha-glasa, with the exiles that were exiled, im Yechaniya. Yechaniya is another name for Yehoyachin. Melech Yehuda. Mordechai, as you would expect, was of the Talmidei Chachamim, who was exiled from Bavel in the first wave of exiles, which you will see is 11 years before the Churban. I didn't mention that yet. Which means Mordechai was initially exiled to Bavel. He eventually found his way to Persia. I'll explain how that happened. But Mordechai was exiled to Bavel, and later he went to Shushan.
What's the difference geographically between Bavel and Persia?
Well, the difference is that Bavel is Iraq and Persia is Iran. I mean, how many miles exactly between Shushan and the city? See, Bavel is both a city and a country. How many miles between, as well as they say, essentially it's the number of miles between approximately Tehran and Baghdad. I don't know how many miles it is. I have to look. But Baghdad,
which
corresponds
one is Iran? Persia.
Iran is Persia.
It's more east.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Iran is Persia. Iraq is Bavel. And Baghdad is the city of Bavel. And Tehran, but it's Persepolis, but it's nearby. It's not exactly where Tehran is, but the ancient capital of Shushan is near Tehran in Iran. So the reference in Megillas Esther is that Mordechai was of the Charash and the Masker, although it doesn't use the word Charash and Masker. Now, there are two questions about Chazal's interpretation. Question number one is, why did Nebuchadnezzar pick on the Talmidei Chachamim? Now, question number two is, why did Hashem want that? Now, that we have an answer to. It says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted the Talmidei Chachamim to be settled in Bavel for almost more than a decade, so by the time the rest of the Jews come to Bavel, it will already be a Makom Torah with yeshivas and learning. So there was a Hashgacha Pratis that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted a Torah society to be established in Bavel, even though that meant that the Jews who were left in Eretz Yisrael were somewhat neglected, that when most of the population comes, there will be a strong Makom Torah. Now that explains the Hashgacha. But what was Nebuchadnezzar's calculation? Like, why did Nebuchadnezzar pick Talmidei Chachamim? Presumably, Nebuchadnezzar's conscious motive had nothing to do with their learning, but Nebuchadnezzar felt Talmidei Chachamim were leaders, they were organizers. He felt that he wanted to remove the educated aristocracy from the Jewish society, so that way there's less probability of rebellion, etc. Now, that's called the Galus of Yehoyachin. The king who succeeded Yehoyachin was Yehoyachin's uncle, Tzidkiyahu. Tzidkiyahu was the last king of Yehuda who ruled Eretz Yisrael for 11 years under Babylonian control. And Tzidkiyahu took an oath of allegiance to Nebuchadnezzar, and in fact his name was not Tzidkiyahu, his name was Matanya. Nebuchadnezzar gave him the name Tzidkiyahu because Ka Hashem Yatztik Olecho Asadin, God will justify whatever punishment you get if you rebel against me. He gave him a name that was a constant reminder, don't rebel against me. Now, the Navi who remained in Yerushalayim during this 11-year period, the Navi who remained, Mordechai was in Babel. The Navi who remained was Yirmiyahu the Navi. Yirmiyahu was there for this whole 11-year period. There were also many, many false prophets. The false prophets were the ones that were saying that Hashem loves the Jewish people. Hashem will protect you. You have the Beis HaMikdash. Fight against Babel. You will overthrow Babel. Hashem is with you. Yirmiyahu was the prophet of doom and gloom. Yirmiyahu was telling the people, do not fight against Babel. If you don't fight against Babel, if you remain subservient, Hashem will let you have a Beis HaMikdash, will let you stay in Yerushalayim. But if you rebel against Babel, you're not zochet to siyata d'shmaya. You will be defeated, the temple will be destroyed, people will be murdered, there'll be a gullus. Yirmiyahu was what you would call in modern parlance an appeaser. Yirmiyahu was the one that was saying, don't fight the enemy, surrender, give in. As a result, there were many, many Jews who considered Yirmiyahu a false prophet. Yirmiyahu was persecuted. Yirmiyahu was thrown into prison. Like Yirmiyahu was tortured. Right? People thought the false Nevi'im were giving the right message. Tzidkiyahu was ambivalent. He was personally a righteous person. But he was influenced by his advisors. In other words, he also didn't want to be unpopular. If he would say, let's surrender to Babel, people would have thought he was a traitor. So as a result, he eventually tried to rebel against Nebuchadnezzar. But this is a fascinating thing. Yirmiyahu gave Tzidkiyahu the following prophecy. If you rebel against Nebuchadnezzar, you will be brought to Babel, you will die in Babel, and your eyes will never see Babel. Very enigmatic prophecy. But what happened was that as a result of Tzidkiyahu's attempt to revolt, Nebuchadnezzar decided to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, to exile the populations, to murder and enslave the Jews. This was 11 years later, so this is called Golus Tzidkiyahu. So the three stages in Golus Babel is the kibush of Yehoyakim, 7 years later, followed by Golus Yehoyachin, or Yechaniah, 11 years later, followed by Golus Tzidkiyahu, which was, of course, the Chorban Beis HaMikdash, which was on the 9th of Avav. So, keep this number in mind. How many years elapsed from the conquest of Eretz Yisrael to the Chorban Beis HaMikdash? 18 years. Because it was 7 years from the conquest to the first Golus, and 11 years from the first Golus to the Chorban. So from the conquest of Yehoyakim to the destruction of the Mikdash was 18 years. That's actually going to be an important number to remember.
And this was the 850-year mark?
And that's the 850-year mark. And that's the 850-year mark from the time Yoshua ben Nun went. So from Knesset L'Eretz Yisrael till the Chorban Bayis Rishon is 850 years. By the way, even the Chorban Bayis Rishon was not the end of all Jewish settlements. Nebuchadnezzar did let a small number of Jewish farmers remain, and he gave them a governor, a quasi-melech, who was called Gedaliah ben Achikam, who was a righteous person. Gedaliah, in turn, was assassinated either on the 3rd of Tishrei or on Rosh Hashanah, but we fast. Since we don't fast on Yom Tov, it's when was Gedaliah killed. But Gedaliah was killed just 2 months after the Chorban. Less than 2 months. The Chorban is the 9th of Av. Gedaliah was killed the Tishrei after that Av. 2 months. Less than 2 months. And that is the nail in the coffin, meaning to say, at that point, the Jews were totally out of Eretz Yisrael. Whoever was left fled to Mitzrayim. And there, the Gemara says there was literally no Jews in Eretz Yisrael. It says it was so desolate and the like. So Tzom Gedalia is the latest event in the Chorban that we commemorate. It was 2 months after the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. Now, the Gemara gives us a remarkable story about Tzidkiyahu, how Yirmiyahu's nevuah was fulfilled. You know, under the Old City, there was something called Ma'aras Tzidkiyahu. I don't know if you've gone there. I don't know if people go there today. This is Tzidkiyahu's cave. You can kind of wander under it. And just like presidents have these subterranean caverns under the White House in case of nuclear attack or 9/11, you know, things like that. So Tzidkiyahu, when Nebuchadnezzar was attacking Yerushalayim, Tzidkiyahu was going to escape under a subterranean cave that he could enter from his palace, and it would take him a certain distance from the city, and then he'd be able to escape into the desert. And the Gemara says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was mazmin a deer that Nebuchadnezzar wanted to hunt. And the deer came out of nowhere. Nebuchadnezzar started riding his horse after the deer, and the deer was going into the direction of Tzidkiyahu's exiting the cave, and exactly as he exited the cave, Nebuchadnezzar's right there. Imagine the terror. And Tzidkiyahu gets apprehended. The first thing Nebuchadnezzar does is he slaughters all of Tzidkiyahu's children in front of his eyes. He then blinds him. So the last thing Tzidkiyahu ever sees on this earth is the torturing and death of his children. He then eventually takes him to Bavel as a trophy to show off, and he murders him in Bavel. And Chazal say, this is exactly a fulfillment of Yirmiyahu's prophecy. You will be brought to Bavel, you will die in Bavel. Your eyes shall never see Bavel, because he was blinded at that point. Okay, and as I say, Yirmiyahu HaNavi, it's not clear when he died exactly. Yirmiyahu was certainly alive at the time of the Chorban. That's why he wrote Eicha about the Chorban. And even in the book of Yirmiyahu, it is said that he was giving chizuk to the Jews who survived Gedalia. After Gedalia was killed, they went down to Mitzrayim. So he gave them chizuk there too. So doesn't say that. There's no pasuk that says when he died.
Mitzrayim.
Huh?
He went down to Mitzrayim?
Yeah, after Gedalia. After Gedalia was killed, the very few Jews that were left went to Mitzrayim. But that was under Babylonian rule anyway. It wouldn't help you, but at least they thought they'd get away from the armies. So Yirmiyahu, so it's posited, I don't know if there's a clear medrash on it, that Yirmiyahu died in Mitzrayim. And he died of natural causes. He was not murdered. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar liked Yirmiyahu. It's very interesting. It's very, very interesting. Why would Nebuchadnezzar like Yirmiyahu? It's actually very logical. Yirmiyahu was the one that was saying, surrender, surrender, surrender. So it mentions that when the Jews were being let out in chains, Medrash Eicha says, Yirmiyahu wanted to be chained with the Jews. He wanted to suffer with the Jews. And Nebuchadnezzar repeatedly ordered that Yirmiyahu be freed from the chains and be given special treatment. And Yirmiyahu was like fighting to get back into the suffering of Am Yisrael, because Nebuchadnezzar actually liked him. Okay, but be it as it may, this was the Malchus of Babel. Now, Nebuchadnezzar was still king at the time of the Chorban. Nebuchadnezzar was succeeded eventually by his son, who went by the name Avil Merodach. Nebuchadnezzar's son was succeeded by the grandson, who is called Belshazzar. Now, in the book of Daniel, Belshazzar is described as Nebuchadnezzar's son, but Chazal say he was really the grandson, and B'nai Banim, Harein Kabanim. Vashti was the daughter of Belshazzar. She happens to be, right? So the Queen Vashti of Persia was actually the daughter of Belshazzar. But okay, be it as it may, I'm going to have to stop soon, and we'll have one more shir on Sunday. Be it as it may, in the book of Daniel, it is recorded that in the third year of Belshazzar's reign, and we'll see why that's important, Belshazzar decides to make a party. This is not Achashverosh's party. This is an earlier party. Belshazzar decides to make a party to commemorate his father's victory over the Jews and the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. And he celebrates by bringing out the gold and the silver kelim, just like Achashverosh will do later, but this is before Achashverosh, the gold and the silver kelim of the Beis HaMikdash that Nebuchadnezzar had plundered. And he is celebrating and glorifying the fact that his grandfather destroyed the house of Hashem.
3 years after destruction was this?
So this is around 50 years after the destruction. It's around 50 years. It's actually 70 years from Nebuchadnezzar becoming king of Babylonia.
It's when the temple was destroyed.
Yeah. Huh? No, it's around 50 years after the temple was destroyed. 50 years after the temple was destroyed. Mm. 50 years, not 70 years, right? Okay, now what happened was, in the book of Daniel, a very, very dramatic, miraculous thing happened. As Belshazzar is celebrating, there is a hand that comes out of Shemayim, a gigantic hand, and writes on the wall. That's how we even have the English expression, when you feel something bad's going to happen, you say, oh, the handwriting is on the wall. Well, this is the handwriting on the wall. And four words are written on the wall. But nobody there is able to read them because it's Ksav Ashuris, it's the holy writing. In other words, it's the Hebrew script. And the Babylonians could not read it. And Daniel is called in to read it. And it's Hebrew letters, but it's Aramaic words. And the words are Mene, Mene, Tekal, Ufarsin. Mene, Mene means your deeds have been counted by Hashem and recounted. Tekal, they have been weighed on a scale and you have been found unworthy. Ufarsin, and your kingdom shall be given to the Persians. Right, the handwriting on the wall. And the book of Daniel ends the perek in a very matter-of-fact conclusion. In one verse it says, that night Belshazzar was killed in bed and his malchus was taken over by Daryavesh Hamadai. In other words, basically, this was a bloodless coup. Right? In other words, except for one guy. In other words, there was no war here. Now, Persia, right, which is Iran, right, the Persian Empire had essentially two ethnic groups. In fact, you see this in Megillas Esther. The two ethnic groups were Madai and Paras. The Medians and the Persians. But right, so sometimes the Persian kings were from Madai. Sometimes they are for Paras. That's why the Megillah talks about Malchei Madai uParas. So the first Persian ruler who took over the Malchus from Belshazzar was Daryavesh HaMadai. And according to the book of Daniel, this was taken over without a war. There was no war. I guess somehow Belshazzar might have been so unpopular that people were willing to surrender the whole thing to this mighty Persian empire. And from now on, therefore, although Jews are still living in Babel, they are now ruled by the Persian empire. That's why we're going to find Mordechai must have moved from Babel to Paras, because to Shushan, because he wanted to plead for the Jewish people where the king was, right? So first it was Babel. Now, Daryavesh HaMadai ruled a relatively short amount of time, and he was succeeded by another Persian king. And this other Persian king is his son-in-law, and that Persian king is known as Koresh. Koresh in English is Cyrus. And in ancient history, he is known as Cyrus the Great. And Koresh issued a proclamation allowing all... Now, this is 52 years after the Churban. 52 years after the Churban. Koresh issued a proclamation allowing all Jews to return to Eretz Yisrael and to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. And not only does he issue a proclamation allowing the Jews to return to Eretz and build the Beis HaMikdash, he even agrees to finance it. He wants to pay for it. Now, you have to understand, it's not so much that he's going to write a check. He basically imposes taxes on the population to give the Jews the money and the materials and the animals and the wood and the gold and the silver to be able to build the Beis HaMikdash. And a number of Jews returned. This is 52 years, not 70 years, 52 years. But we'll see that they were not Zocha to build the Beis HaMikdash. We'll discuss that next time. But that's why I just want to make one point here. That is, it's very important to know that on one hand, Kairish is praised by the Nevi'im as being the Mashiach Hashem. He's a non-Jew that is called Hashem's Mashiach because he was Hashem's emissary in allowing the Yidden to come back to Eretz Yisrael. But it's important to know the majority of the Jewish people did not come back. In fact, we're given an exact number. We are given the number in the book of Ezra that around, I don't remember the exact number, but it's around 42,000. It's less than 50,000. Way less than 50,000. It's the earlier, right, the lesser part of the 40s, less than 45,000. And that is estimated to be less than 10% of the population. How, you know, again, we don't know exactly how many Jews there were, but if you're talking about 45,000, even if there's a million Jews, right, if there's a million Jews, so 45,000 is 5%. Around 5%. 50, that would be 5%, right? If there's 2 million Jews, it's 2.5%. A very, very small percentage of Jews went back. And what's interesting is, the book of Ezra wants to give honor to these courageous Jews. Because you have to understand, first of all, going back to Eretz Yisrael after this Chorban is not like coming to Eretz Yisrael today. The land was totally devastated. If you ever saw pictures of Warsaw or Berlin or Hiroshima or Nagasaki after World War II, that's what Eretz Yisrael was like. Everything was destroyed. In Bavel, Yidden had become comfortable. In fact, Yirmiyahu HaNavi told them to make a life and contribute. So you can understand why a Jew might be very reluctant to come back to Eretz Yisrael under those circumstances. And only less than 45,000 did so. But it's a badge of honor. The families are memorialized. Now, obviously, we're not given a list of 45,000 people, but the way the book of Ezra is written is it does it by families. It'll say, you know, 1,500 members of this mishpacha came back, and, 300 people from the city of Beis Lechem came back, so you have a way of reconstructing. Now, when you learn that part of Tanakh, most of us fall asleep. I mean, it's like reading a telephone book. You know, it's of no interest. But you have to understand, if you were descended from those families, this is like a badge of honor, a badge of esteem. The first people who came back when nobody else was willing to come back. It was put there as kavod for these mishpachas, a tremendous, tremendous, tremendous honor. And when people knew their family trees much more than we know today, people paid very close attention to this to try to trace themselves. Today we don't know. Nobody knows where they come from. So it has less of a message to us. But it's a very chashuv thing. Okay, now I'm going to end with this point that the successor to Kairish was Achashverosh. Right? So what is happening therefore is, when is the story of Purim happening? It is happening at a time when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, at a time when Jews were permitted to go back to Eretz Yisrael, but most of them did not. At a time when the Beis HaMikdash was begun, but we were not allowed to continue it. But it's towards the end of the 70 years. In point of fact, the Persian king under whose rule the temple was rebuilt is the son of Achashverosh. And that son of Achashverosh is also named Daryavish. He's called Daryavish II. And according to Chazal's tradition, he was a son that Achashverosh had from Queen Esther, which would make him halachically Jewish, although we don't know if he considered himself Jewish. So it's an interesting irony that the non-Jew, the so-called Persian king who allowed the building of the Bayis Sheni, was a Jew. It's like a Jewish pope type of thing. Now, this actually explains something else about Mordechai. Let me just mention something. When you look at the list of those courageous Jews who came back after Koresh's proclamation, you actually find the name Mordechai on the list. So the question is, well, hey, is that the Mordechai of Purim? Maybe not. Maybe it's another Mordechai. But many Mefarshim learn, and this would be logical, that Mordechai was exiled in Bavel 11 years before the Chorban. So actually, Mordechai is already pretty old. We don't know, right? Because 11 years before the Chorban, And Koresh made his proclamation 52 years after the Churban. Right? So Mordechai has been in Galus 63 years already. We don't know how old he was before that point. He was already a Talmud Chacham 63 years before. So Mordechai, so some of us say the following. Mordechai jumped on the bandwagon. As soon as Koresh gave Rishus, Mordechai went to Eretz Yisrael. But what happened was this. When, in the days of Achashverosh, the Jews no longer had permission to build the Beis HaMikdash, we'll discuss that Achashverosh was the one that stopped it, Mordechai then moved to Shushan to attempt to be an emissary and an intercessor on behalf of the Jewish community. Okay, so this explains, now did Mordechai go back to Eretz Yisrael? That we don't know. We really don't know. And in fact, I believe that in Iran, the Jews have a place that they identify as the kever of Mordechai and Esther. So it's not clear if Mordechai ever made it back. That's not so pashut. He may have died, etc. But what I'm saying is, the trajectory of Mordechai is, he was exiled to Bavel 11 years before the Churban with the Talmidei Chachamim. And 63 years later, he responded, as an elderly man, he responded to Koresh's declaration, even though most of the Jews did not. So he went from Bavel to Yerushalayim. And then when the Binyan Beis HaMikdash was ceased in the days of Achashverosh, he went to Shushan. And that's why it always says he's Yoshe B'Shar HaMelech. Apparently he tried to occasionally intercede on behalf of the Jewish people, right? So it goes from Yerushalayim to Bavel to Yerushalayim to Shushan. And there's a lot of uncertainty. Did he die in Shushan? Or did he was he Zeicher to come back to Eretz Yisrael? Okay, so that's kind of the initial historical background, but we'll continue with some more details.
Did the Jews stay in Israel even after Koresh died?
Say again?
The Jews that went there?
Yes. Koresh or Achashverosh did not stop the Jews from living in Eretz Israel, but they stopped the Binyan Beis HaMikdash.
What was the
reason? In fact, yeah, so the reason was that the Book of Ezra records that there were enemies of the Jews that convinced Koresh and then Achashverosh that the Beis HaMikdash would be a point of rebellion. They could gather their armies there. And this is really very, very, very interesting. Who these enemies are is not identified at all. But Rashi brings a medrash that the enemies were the Aseres B'nei Haman, that Haman's 10 adult children were the ones who got the Beis HaMikdash construction stopped. So even before Haman is even in government here, the Aseres B'nei Haman were malshin, they were slandering the Jewish people. Okay? And this is the first Rashi. You should look at the first Rashi. Now, the first Rashi in Megillas Esther is a very interesting Rashi, and I think with this background you'll understand it. It says, Achashverosh was the king in whose reign the Beis HaMikdash was stopped through the slander of the Aseres B'nei Haman. Okay? Okay, so that's where the story of Purim takes place.